You and I chatting it up back together again, wrapping up a busy week Friday, September 13th, 2024 on Connecticut Today, where I kicked off the show looking at the growing conspiracy theories connected to Tuesday's presidential debate. GOP State Senator Rob Sampson dropped by to chat about a recent controversy surrounding curbside voting in Bridgeport. CBS News reporter Chris Fox joined us from Austin, Texas, with details on another report that looks at the 2022 Uvalde mass school shooting and their response. Finally, former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso capped off the week with his regular thoughts on all things Bridgeport, including the mess at Success Village.
Okay, so can we just stop this lunacy that I'm starting to see and hear from? Again, I hate to say this, from a lot of my friends, a lot of people I know on the right side of the political spectrum, is some of this stuff has, in fact, all of it's got to stop. Please stop with the conspiracy crap unless you have hard and fast evidence. I'm an evidence-based guy, and evidence is not something on social media. Evidence is not something that, well, somebody said something, and they said it, and she saw, she heard. Stop it. The Republican Party and conservatives should not be the party of stupid. If you have evidence, put it forward, but my God, calm down. You're all losing your minds. This story here, and again, this has been floating around since the debate on Tuesday. Kamala Harris did not receive debate questions in advance. ABC News says absolutely not. ABC News has denied that Harris was given advance notice of questions ahead of her debate showdown with former President Trump. Absolutely not. An ABC News spokesperson told the Daily Beast Harris was not given any questions before the debate. None of her aides were in contact with the debate moderators, David Muir and Lindsay Davis, ahead of Tuesday night's face-off in Philadelphia, the network said. Now, if you don't believe that, you better have some hard and fast evidence to back it up. And maybe you do. Let's see it. I mean, I saw this stuff debate night, and I'm watching a lot of people on X, local people and national people I follow. Well, no, she had to have the questions. No, she didn't. You know what the problem was Tuesday night? Donald Trump stunk out the joint. That's the problem. His reaction and overreaction to stuff and people eating dogs and cats and birds and fish and turtles and everything, that's how you let the gas out and the air out of your own balloon. The point-blank denial comes after Trump, who described the debate as unfair and rigged, floated the idea that Harris had been given a heads-up on what questions to expect. Quote, I watched her talk and I said, you know, she seems awfully familiar with the questions, he told Fox News and Fox and Friends just hours after the debate. Now, Mr. Trump, sir, Mr. President, with all due respect, maybe that's because she prepared. Maybe that's because she hunkered down for 2 or 3 weeks knowing that this may very well be the make or break moment of the campaign, and she took it seriously. It is mind-numbing we're going down this road. All this coming, the New York Post says, as the 45th president and his campaign aides have repeatedly argued that his Democratic rival was given an unfair advantage during their first and most likely only debate. Maybe the advantage is, and a lot of you people don't want to see it, that she prepped for it. Maybe you took her too lightly. Now, again, I still want to see her do a real news conference, unscripted, where she doesn't know what questions are coming, because I still have my doubts there. But my God, you know, when I worked on a couple of campaigns, you know what we do with our candidates? Debate prep. It's called sitting down, isolating time, either full days or several hours of each day sitting there caucusing and saying, okay, what if they ask you this, that, or this? And then a couple of days before the debate with a candidate I was working with, we were at an office, and as the candidate was doing her normal work duties, myself and a couple of other people were just sitting in the office firing questions at them. It's called debate prep. And again, listen, you have to understand something. I mean, if you don't think, come on, you can't be buying this. You don't think that they went over every single possible subject that would be brought up? You don't think that? You think she just walked in and showed up in Philadelphia last night and said, oh, good, let's have a debate? No, she was prepared. They had a game plan. He wasn't. So can we please, for the love of Jesus, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, whatever, whatever the Trinity is, can you please stop this lunacy? People are just cracking up here. Now, maybe you're saying this because you're mad that, you know, now he may lose. Maybe he's going to lose anyway. I don't know. And frankly, I don't care. But again, I say this all the time. All the stuff that's alleged, the election rigging, I'm open to it. I'm open to it. I have nothing against you. If you think something is rigged, something isn't on the up and up, but you better darn well have evidence for it. That's it. Don't go crazy. Don't go nuts. Well, she had to know the questions. No, she didn't have to know the questions, but I'm sure she went over several areas like health care and like abortion and like foreign leaders, because she put together what was called a game plan, like your favorite NFL teams do, starting the Monday after a Sunday game. And they work at it, and they have practice squads, and they outline things, and they go over film. That's how you win. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Do you honestly think she had the questions? Or do you understand that there's a difference between having the questions and having a good idea of what is going to be asked? All right, good to have this gentleman on. Joins us every so often, Republican State Senate member Rob Sampson. He represents the 16th District, which could be you if you habitate or work around, say, Walcott, Milldale, Southington, Prospect, and those areas. Hey, Rob, it's Paul again. Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Delighted to speak with you, Paul.
Couple things here, Rob. Let's go over some things that have been in the news here. And obviously, you are the ranking member of the Government Administration Elections Committee. So, Rob, I will admit to you, in all the times we've spoken before, I don't think we've ever talked about curbside voting. And shockingly, Rob, there's a controversy with that in Bridgeport, about people being a little too persuasive doing this. So where and how, Rob Sampson, is curbside voting allowed here? And what do you make of some of these allegations coming out of Bridgeport here?
Controversy, you don't say. In
shocking.
Bridgeport,
shocking, Rob. I'm shocked, yes.
You're knocking me over.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, curbside voting first appeared during the pandemic as a mechanism to accommodate certain folks who, wanted to vote in person, didn't vote by absentee, but also were not able or did not wish to actually enter the polling location. And it was a mechanism devised by the Secretary of State at the time, Denise Merrill, as a way to accommodate those folks. And I don't know that it was a terrible idea, but it does come with problems, because everything that has to do with our election system in the state is all about ballot security, maintaining the proper custody of that ballot so that there's no question that, that voter is the one that filled out that ballot, and that it can be tracked from the voter all the way to the time it's counted. And, some of that goes away when you're, collecting ballots outside of the polling location. Bridgeport's notorious for ballot harvesting, and that's the same thing. We come to your house and pick up your ballot type voting. I mean, it's dramatic. I don't know that curbside voting, could be done without problems, but I've read some of the recent newspaper stories, and the one story in the CT Mirror, talking about the Bridgeport councilman who was actually driving voters up to curbside voting himself. That seems like something that probably should not be allowed.
Yeah, and Robin, listen, I know it would probably cost money and there might be some logistical problems, but, you know, I can see if somebody wants to say, hey, I'm elderly or I'm immunocompromised, so just take my ballot. I mean, in an ideal world, Robin, if I were king, and sad to say I'm not, okay, then that should be handed to a police officer or a marshal or a judicial marshal, and then they can walk it into the polling place. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Now, there needs to be some mechanism, unless you're going to put, you know, both registrars, the Democrat and Republican registrar, out on the curb, and they've got more important things to do inside monitoring that election. My opinion is that, you know, we already have a system to accommodate people that cannot vote in person on election day, and that's absentee voting. It's it's long existed in the state. It worked perfectly fine up until the Democrats started tinkering with it back, you know, in the 2010s. And have expanded it dramatically, redefining the definition of illness and allowing for all of this mail-in voting and basically obscuring what was once a working system into something that is fraught with problems these days. And I'd like to go back to the way it was. One day in-person voting and a limited but very reasonable and accommodating no-excuse absentee system that takes care of people that truly need it. You know, people in the military, people that are elderly, people that are actually sick or out of town.
Mm-hmm.
It works before. It can work again.
Rob, I know you and some other legislators there on the GOP side had some concerns a couple of months ago when an explanation was given as to the ballot question we're going to see in November about allowing you folks in the General Assembly basically to get the keys to the car and start looking at no-excuse absentee balloting, which, Rob, as I say, and as anybody says, if they're being, you know, genuine about this, basically is mail-in voting, which, again, technically I'm not against because other states have done it, but they have they've been very upfront about it out in the Pacific Northwest, a very detailed open process here. And I don't know, what are your thoughts on that? Because I know the description that was handed down by a committee did not sit well with everyone.
Right. Well, that's a two-part question. I mean, the first thing is I had concerns with the question ultimately that's going to appear on this November's ballot that would authorize the majority party, whoever that is, and I think you could probably guess it may stay the same after this election day, to effectively design what our no-excuse absentee voting system is. And it could be far more than just mail-in voting, Paul. It could be voting on your phone, for crying out loud. I mean, I have very, very grave concerns about what they will do when given the power to open the door that wide. But the issue I had with the question is that back in 2014, when a similar ballot initiative was put before voters, they actually included in the question that people would be allowed to vote without appearing in person at the polls. And it failed. And I think that's the reason why it failed. I think that most people are not comfortable with that. They want to see the vast majority of voters actually appear in person where there's some level of security. And of course, they took it out this time. And you ask yourself, why did they take it out? And we already know the answer, because they know that that's what kept it from passing. And they want it to pass this time. And they are not above tinkering with the question in a way to deceive voters. It's shady business, Paul. It's as simple as that.
Rob Sampson is the guest. Rob, just to wrap up here, let's shift to this whole electric mess. And we know about the bills and the public benefits charge and everything. But now there are reports, Rob, that the governor is trying to kind of enter into an agreement with Governor Healey in Massachusetts. The latest reports late yesterday and today saying, hey, we may still go along with this wind power if the per kilowatt hour charge is reasonable. And I guess the governor is trying now to get Massachusetts to, I guess, in a roundabout way, ease the burden on ratepayers by getting Massachusetts to buy some Millstone power. Are you hearing anything to that end? What have you heard over the past few days? And what about the governor saying, hey, time out on this? You think he's sincere about this or what?
I would say no, I don't think he's sincere. And I don't think that there's any real effort to address the fact that people's electric bills continue to skyrocket. If they actually had any real concerns over on the Democrat side, the governor was concerned or the majority leaders in either the House or Senate, they would have brought us in for a special session. They know that there are things coming that we can address right this minute to solve a lot of this problem and provide relief, but they are just failing to do so. And I would just add this, be very concerned, people of Connecticut, if there's going to be some sort of negotiation with Massachusetts or Rhode Island or whomever about buying wind power, because wind power is going to be through the roof expensive. You know, the Democrats' number one reaction to this whole thing when me and my Republican colleagues, you know, started banging the drum about, you know, how we have to provide relief from the public benefits charges. Well, look back to 2017 and the Millstone deal and all that. Well, your listeners should know that Millstone costs 5 cents a kilowatt hour, which is sometimes more and sometimes less than natural gas. And that's where that issue comes from. But the fact of the matter is, if the Democrats had their way, we would be buying wind and solar, not nuclear, and it would be costing 10, 15, 20 cents a kilowatt hour. And if that's the kind of deal that they think that they're putting together, they wouldn't use the word reasonable. I think my definition of reasonable and the governor's definition are probably totally different.
And Rob, just to finish up on this, so do you guys and gals in the legislature have any purvey on these deals, or can this be just the governor with an executive action and also the deep commissioner? Is there anything legislatively that can be done about this, or does this have to be approved by you folks or not?
It does not have to be approved. The authority rests with PURA, which is the state agency with the governor's appointments. They are the ones that engage in the power purchase agreement, and effectively they have, you know, full negotiating power to do that. I mean, that doesn't mean the legislature could not meet and pass a law. We could pass a law to increase or decrease or intervene the amount of influence and power that PURA has to make those decisions. But as it stands, I think that they can do it on their own.
All right. Rob Sampson, 16th District, Republican State Senate member. Rob, good to chat with you. We'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much, Paul.
All right, Rob, be good. Back here on a Friday, Connecticut Today, a federal agency has released a report today about the tragic mass shooting at the Robb Elementary School back in May of 2022. 19 students and two teachers killed, 17 others hurt before the gunman, 18-year-old Salvador Ramos, was shot and killed by officials. This report, though, delves into some specifics there and also looks at the overall response. And joining us right now from Austin, Texas, is CBS reporter Chris Fox with more of that. Chris, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. Who issued this report, Chris, and what does it say, basically?
The report came from Homeland Security. It deals with Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection, and their role. There are 188 Border Patrol agents that were that responded to the school shooting at Robb Elementary back two and a half years ago. It just seems like it was yesterday. This report kind of gives a different perspective, the perspective of Border Patrol. And Border Patrol, if you remember, they're the ones credited for actually breaching the classroom and taking down the gunman. So the report goes into a lot of detail specifics about that. While it is also extremely critical of the 118 Border Patrol agents for what they did the 77 minutes prior, leading up to from the moment the Salvador Ramos started shooting. And questions very similar in that same story, different perspective, the story being the same. Failures were lack of leadership, lack of established command. And that, that was everyone blamed the school district police chief because of the school active shooter policy dictated that he was in command, his attorney, and he has argued, and his attorney recently filing a motion to dismiss charges against him, arguing that he was not the chief at that moment. He was a first responder, therefore he should not or could not have been in command. But it kind of spells out a picture of no one knew who to trust or who to talk to or who was doing what. It also kind of goes into the confusion from the Border Patrol perspective about what their role is in dealing with non-federal events like this. And so the argument being they weren't really sure what to do. Now, as the story goes, it was BORTAC, which is the tactical division of the Border Patrol, who is credited with breaching the classroom. And the report goes into a lot more detail and specifics about inside the classroom, what it looked like, who went in first. It's citing Ramos jumped out of a closet in the classroom firing, bullets hitting the ballistic shield that the Border Patrol agent had. The Border Patrol agent then firing his pistol, firing off round after round until his gun malfunctioned, but behind him by that point were officers and other officials with rifles who were able to take him down. So it kind of paints it's a bit more transparent than other reports. The DOJ report, the DOJ investigation, also the investigation and report released by the Texas State House of Representatives, which were all pretty detailed. But this one gives that perspective of what Border Patrol saw when they walked in the classroom. And it is it's very difficult to read.
Chris Fox, but the notion that people may have from 1,000 miles away on this is, wait a minute, why was CBP called in? We remember the confusion there. Could the police not handle this? Did CBP take it upon themselves? Is this something they would have normally responded to, Chris, or not?
So many people, so many CBP agents live there. And one of the things I noticed when I was driving there the day of the shooting, how many Border Patrol agents were between San Antonio and Uvalde? I mean, 30, 40 along the side of the highway.
Yeah.
And so many of them live there and are part of the community. And so assume the role, as we're understanding, because one of the things that the report asks for is clarification of law.
Yeah.
As it pertains to what authority Customs and Border Protection have in these types of instances. And so also it brought up something interesting. They didn't have the training for it. And so a lot of the wording seemed very similar to the DOJ reports and the State House report, in that there was just confusion and not knowing who to listen to. Radios, remember, did not work in the hallway.
Yeah.
They had two groups of people stationed at either end of the hallway who couldn't talk to each other. And so there's a lot of lack of active shooter training as it pertains to Border Patrol in this case. But it was also the same thing was cited in the DOJ report for state and local police as well. And so their training did not prepare them for this. At least Border Patrol did. There are arguments that Texas Department of Public Safety, the state police, their training did prepare them, and they didn't do it. They didn't act on it. But a lot of people are, again, pointing the finger saying no one knew who was in charge.
Wow. Chris, finally, going forward, does the report, as you read it and as you've digested it, does it make any recommendations going forward? Any hard rule changes here, or is this kind of still something in process here?
No, it's interesting. The recommendations are very similar to the others and the other reports in that better active shooter training, better equipment, better protocols. It is interesting also that another angle is the families of the victims. Their responses have been rather divided. Some saying that they appreciate the transparency and they want as much information as they can get. Others arguing, why'd it take 2.5 years to get this report out? Mm. Also saying, why is no one being held accountable? Because that's another argument being made, is this report comes out and basically, like the City of Uvalde report, exonerated all their local police.
Yeah.
And this kind of does the same thing. While it says there were massive failures, nothing indictable. There has been two indictments. The police chief of the school district, Peter Adondo, multiple charges of child endangerment and failure to lead. Also, Adrian Gonzalez, one of his officers, also, I think, 10 charges of child endangerment. But those are the only two. And the families are saying, wait a minute, there's more failure to go around.
Yeah.
And why is no one else being held accountable? So the families, you know, Brett Cross, the father of Uzziah Garcia, went online last night and read the entire report for 2 hours and 17 minutes.
Wow.
With others chiming in their feelings. And a lot of their feelings were what did you learn? Did you learn to open a door? Because it took 40 minutes for them to find the keys to the door. And then they found out the lock was broken anyway, and the door wasn't locked.
Wow.
The other thing Brett Cross saying is, did you learn not to wait 77 minutes? What have we actually learned? And that's what where the frustration comes. It's amazing when you go to Uvalde, you speak to the people, you speak to State Senator Roland Gutierrez, who represents the area. And multiple times, I've found myself just weeping as we talk. Uh-huh. And then seconds later, angry, mad as hell. And that is exactly the feeling of the people in Uvalde. And it's still that way.
I can imagine. CBS reporter Chris Fox in Austin. Chris, thank you. We really appreciate it. Take care, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much.
The only oil we care about is Berrio olive oil, but that's another story.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. There we go.
That's the best. Nice oil.
Oh, beautiful. Know? Mr. Caruso, how are you? And I would imagine you, like a lot of us, are sitting here just shaking our heads and worried about this circus at Success Village here. What are your thoughts on
it? Oh, isn't it true? Well, it's really sad for the residents of the Success Village, frankly. You know, it's a great community. I know many of the people there. When I ran for mayor, they were very welcoming and hospitable. And it's just a shame what they're going through. And it seems to be a management issue. That not just seems, it's factually, it's a management issue.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be a lot of animosity toward the leadership of Success Village. And frankly, it was an ambush, you know, to declare bankruptcy like that.
Yeah.
And the only ones that will suffer are the people that live there. And that's the saddest thing. I'm happy to see the federal judge who's handling the bankruptcy has ordered a hearing. I think it's September 18th, if I'm not mistaken, before her to try to clarify the mess, which is the whole receivership issue. So my hope is that she'll allow the receivership to go through. If she wants to declare the bankruptcy, you know, after evidence, that's fine. But at least she'll have a receivership to run the place properly. I think the people deserve that much. And it's just tragic. You know, you start off last year, they had funds available. Things were moving along well. And now this year, it seems like there's no funds available.
Yeah.
You know, the money, the common charges have been squandered. And you know, many of the residents aren't paying common charges. They're putting their common charges in escrow because of the way, frankly, the facilities are being run.
And
very sad. It's tragic.
It is. And Chris, just one more quick thing on that. I mean, and then there's health concerns. I mean, there was a story or this rumbling that what if the health directors in Bridgeport and Stratford say, well, no, if you don't have consistent heat or hot water, we're not going to okay a certificate of occupancy. Then what happens?
Oh. Well, that's good. You know, listen, I think at that point, you know, and frankly, you know, the governor and the state should have declared a state of emergency. They're both on public safety and public health. And by doing that, there would have been federal funds available, state funds available to correct the problem. And it seems like in some ways everyone's passing the buck. And it finally came down where the state or the city, I should say, of Stratford and Bridgeport came in and said it needs to be corrected.
Yeah.
But that should have been done months ago. You know, when the issue came up, people that don't have hot water, they don't have heat in their units, especially the hot water, you know, leads to disease and to other health problems. So, you know, frankly, I don't know. The government was very slow to respond to correct the problem. These issues didn't happen overnight, Paul.
No, of course.
And frankly, the state should have stepped in earlier and declared the emergency, and then funding would be available at that point to correct many of these problems. And, you know, what they're talking about are temporary fixes.
Yeah, well, we talked about that.
That should not be there.
Yeah. Chris, do you know, let me ask you this, Chris Caruso joins us. Chris, can you and I hop in a car, we'll have some ballots, we'll go down to a curbside voting area, and maybe they'll descend on us like a NASCAR pit stop? What the heck is up with this?
Oh. Well, you know, Paul, I think every time you pass a law that makes it more accessible for voters to actually, you know, cast their ballot and vote, there's always going to be these characters that are going to step up and try to violate the law. They do it in front of the polling place now as far as the 75-foot rule.
Yeah.
And, you know, one year I was chief moderator. This was many years ago, and I had jurisdiction over all the elections. I had to throw a mayoral candidate. He was actually the mayor of Bridgeport. I had to throw him out of the building. And he looked at me and he said, "Do you know who I am?" And I said,
Yes, exactly.
That's why I'm telling you to get out of here. You're a candidate. And then a couple of his people got a little, you know, blustery with me. And the cop was with me. When you're chief moderator, you have a police officer. So I said, "Officer, would you please remove the mayor?" And he looked at me and he said, "He's the mayor." And I said, "Well,
I don't care.
You start either." I said, "It's against the law." And we removed him from the building.
Wow.
And there's a reason for that. So Now, when you allow access in the sense the poll worker brings the ballot out to the car, now you have this swarm of political people. And frankly, people don't give a damn. They're characters, and they're just going to violate the law.
Yeah.
And they swarm the car, and the voter doesn't have the privacy to cast their vote. And the other sad thing is, you know, they're casting their vote, and now people know how they're voting.
Well,
That shouldn't be. You know, years ago, I heard in Bridgeport, Paul, you're going to laugh at this, years ago during Jasper McLevy's time, they used to have polling places in stores, like, you know, convenience stores. So down on the bottom floor, you had the voting machine, and above, they used to drill a hole, and they watch how the guy would vote. And so if he didn't vote for the candidate, when they came out of the store, they beat the hell out of him.
Oh, come on.
You know. And apparently a lot of people have mentioned that, you know, from years ago, but you know, it's the same thing here. Why should the voter be exposed to political people and campaign operatives? It needs to be private. But again, Paul, you know, every time you try to make the law better so people can access, you're always going to have the criminal element that's going to try to take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about this how many times, Paul?
Oh, my God.
The only way you're going to correct this stuff is with jail time.
Yeah.
The only way you're going to do it. You know, you get a couple of political operatives in jail, and let me tell you.
Then all of a sudden, right? Right?
That's exactly. You know,
all right.
My mother raised me, Paul, to tell me that if I ever got in trouble with the police and I was in jail.
Oh.
She said, you're going to sit there.
You're going to sit there.
She said, I'm not bailing you out.
Or as my parents used to say, I better not get a phone call. That phone better not ring. Right?
Exactly right, Paul. Oh, exactly
man.
Right.
Chris Caruso, always great listening to you and hearing from you on a Friday. Chris, have a good weekend. And do me a favor.
You too now.
Like our president running again, don't eat the cats and dogs, okay? Just want to make sure you...
And I just have to tell you, Paul, I did not steal the geese from the pond, okay?
Thanks, Chris. Take care.
All right, take
bye-bye.
Care.
Bye-bye.